That's right, yeah. Chip down there. She wanna jump up, wanna free up and live in the dream. Inception, she on that soul. Tell the girl, bring the waist, let me wind it up. And every brother, bring a bottle, let me beat it up. Rasta girl, bring the jam, let me grind it. Then join it up. Yeah, we'll be having the time when it's time. Broadcast program.
It's 2 o'clock in Montreal. You're listening to The Mosaic Show from the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM, and I'm Sarah Hassanin. As the humanitarian crisis persists in Ukraine, Mosaic's been keen to know more about the situation there. Here's an interview with Stephanie Pickard, a former McGill student who works for Red Cross Canada and who has lately been to Slovakia, Ukraine, Romania, and Hungary. Pranjal Malik has more.
I'm Pranjal Malik, and today we have with us Stephanie Pickard, who's a former McGill student and now works for the Canadian Red Cross. Stephanie, would you like to introduce yourself in your own words?
Hi, Pranjal. Yeah, thanks so much for having me, first and foremost. It's really a great pleasure to be able to speak with you and talk about the work we've been doing in Ukraine and surrounding countries. I've been with the Red Cross for 7 years now, and I work in communications. Well, my full-time job is to work with emergency operations that take place in Canada and around the world. And at times I'm sent internationally when there's support needed.
We found out that you were in Slovakia, Romania, Hungary, and Ukraine just a few weeks ago. So what was your experience like seeing these situations of crisis so closely?
Yeah, it was actually, I was part of a team that was deployed there to meet with partners on the ground and to continue to coordinate the aid that's been deployed to people that are affected by the crisis since the first hours and even before the conflict escalated in February. And so being there on the ground, you know, we heard so much about this crisis situation and the direct impact that it had on people that had to flee or people that were in besieged areas and were stuck. And so I actually went to Ukraine to an area where people are seeking refuge. And so it was really incredible to witness the solidarity that's at every single place that I visited. Yes, there are Red Cross personnel and volunteers that are there helping around the clock, but also the whole community has mobilized to help people. And so a lot of people are staying with host families. And so it's putting a lot of pressure on families, but they're opening their homes for people to stay in their place, whether it's in Ukraine or in the surrounding countries. And that was really exceptional to witness.
Oh my God, no, that sounds really great. Just people coming together in times of need. And do you have some like examples or stories of how like the funding is helping people in Ukraine and the surrounding countries as well?
Yeah, we're really grateful to people across Canada that have really stepped up to help people that are impacted by the Ukraine crisis. And so it's really provided the opportunity to give, to respond to urgent needs, but also to look beyond and look at, because this crisis will have consequences, unfortunately, for the not only the days, the weeks, the months, but the years to come. And so there's a number of different ways that Red Cross is helping, ways that I got to witness myself. One of the key ways is the Red Cross, whether it is directly in Ukraine or in the neighboring countries where millions of people have fled, there's Red Cross along the way. At multiple points along people's kind of journey as they choose or are forced to flee the areas where there's conflict or there's a risk of conflict. And so in Ukraine, I saw at a train station, for example, we had volunteer teams that were there, and at 10 p.m. at night, there was a train with 400 people that were arriving from a region that is directly impacted, so where there are hostilities taking place. And people were arriving, you know, we talk about like they have little luggage. Sometimes they only have bags. It's mostly women, children, and people that are older adults, and there was a number of people with disabilities. And so our volunteers were helping them off the train and bringing them into the train station, where we are also there to provide them first and foremost with comfort, and then also with really key information. People need to know, how do I get to the next place I want to go to, whether that's in Ukraine with a family or in a shelter, or if I want to move on to another country. And then also giving them food. So we had food parcels with, you know, ready-made food, but also food that they could cook if they had access to a kitchen. We give kitchen sets as well as some activities for children. So, I mean, I mentioned they travel with, you know, sometimes a couple of bags and their children. And so you can imagine that they don't have access to toys or activities, coloring books that they may be used to having back home. So that's one of the examples of the help that we're providing. And those types of service points are accessible in train stations throughout the country, in many cities, but also at border crossings. So I saw one of those sites where there's people around the clock in Romania, as well as Slovakia, which are the two borders that I crossed to go into Ukraine. And there's some of these service lines throughout the region. So whether it's in Poland or in Moldova or as well in Hungary, there's these service points so that people have a safe place to go and get what they need in the immediate moment where they're fleeing and moving on to another place.
Oh, that is really a heartbreaking situation, what you explained, and Red Cross is doing amazing work, really. The next question I had was just, how can we help? Like, how can we donate to the humanitarian crisis in surrounding countries? Like, how's the money sent to them? And if there's any way possible, or what are the ways possible in which people can help?
Yeah, and thanks so much for asking that. I mean, I've witnessed firsthand how people's donations are used, and really the best way to help is by a financial donation. And the reason for that is that it really allows us to respond to the needs of the people that are there. And so I spoke about how people are moving around quite a bit. And so needs are forever changing. You know, people may move to another country, choose to stay there for a certain period of time, but a lot of people are going back and forth as well. And so the best way to help is by financial donations. If people are able to donate, we have the Ukraine Humanitarian Crisis Appeal. The way the money is sent is, so the Red Cross is part of the Red Crescent movement, which really works as a coordinated movement in order to provide the most efficient, effective, and impactful help possible. And so there's a Red Cross in Ukraine, and there's Red Cross in all of the surrounding countries where people are fleeing to. And so the money is really provided through the movement, and then it's a coordinated effort to make sure that people receive the help that they need. And so, you know, one of the examples, which is really concrete, is that there's been money distributed. So really direct financial transfers to people that are impacted in Ukraine and in countries like Slovakia, Romania, and other surrounding countries, so that people actually have cash. They're able to access money and they can identify what they need to spend money on. What are their needs? And that's really empowering. From the perspective where they're not just given, you know, an item that's been decided is what they need, which is also really important, you know, blankets, food, hygiene kits, but also they can make decisions for themselves. And that also encourages local purchasing as well in places where there may be very limited such opportunities to support local markets. And so that's just one of the examples where your financial donations are really providing direct financial assistance to people that are there.
Definitely. No, that is also like just amazing. Would you like to drop a link or just information on how people can do that and just
Oh, yeah, for sure. People can go to redcross.ca to donate. So you'll find the link to the Ukraine Humanitarian Crisis Appeal there. Or they can call 1-800-418-1111. So that's 1-800-418-1111 to make a financial donation. So really, thanks so much to anyone who has the means to do so. It's really very much appreciated.
That's perfect. Thank you so much for your time. And you are really just doing amazing work. Thank you so much for taking time out of your
day. Are continuing to be impacted every day. And so really appreciate the opportunity to talk about the work and for your support and to provide people with a way to help if they can.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephanie. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
And that was Pranjal Malik and an interview with Stephanie Pickard, a former McGill student who works for Red Cross Canada. You're listening to Mosaic from the CKT Radio at 90.3 FM, and I'm Sarah Hassanin. Stay tuned.
أبداً بوجوده مع إنه قريب وفي حد يفارق ويسيبنا إنما بيعيش جوه قلوبنا بتغيب الشمس إنما اسمه عمره ما بيغيب في فرق ما بين جسم بيمشي وروح ما بتمشيش واللي انت أكيد سايبه ما بيننا تدلنا نسيان فرحت كتير وهوجه دورنا ومعك هنكمل مشوار أصل ما فيش في الدنيا دي أغلى من روح إنسان وعشان أجيال بعدنا جايين يفضلوا فاكرين يفضلوا عارفين وعشانك حتة منا وعشان تفكر ما بينا يفضل اسمك معانا سنين وسنين وعشان أجيال بعدنا
is at its best when it speaks truth to power. Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Aqla was shot by Israeli snipers on May 11 while covering the atrocities at the Jenin camp in Palestine. But her legacy will still hold up, and the memory of her bravery will never fade, and no one can take that from us. Rima Raji talks to Haytham Qureshi, one of Shireen Abu Aqla's neighbors from Palestine. Qureshi lives in Maryland in the U.S. Today, he takes us on a reminiscent journey as he recollects his memories with Aqla back in their homeland, occupied Palestine. Qureshi is also the coordinator of the Museum for the Palestinian People.
Okay, so before we get started with the questions, can you just briefly introduce yourself, where you're from, where you grew up, where you work, volunteer, etc.?
Okay, sweet. So my name is Haytham Qureshi. I am a Palestinian living here in Maryland in the United States. Originally, my family is from the city of Tul Kerem in Palestine, which is half of it's in the West Bank, half of it's in the occupied territories now under Israel. So it's kind of split between East and West. So I was born in the state of Maryland. And then when I was 6 years old in 2002, I moved to the West Bank. I moved to Palestine during the Second Intifada, so which was a really, really difficult period, especially for us as Palestinians in terms of freedom of movement, rights, access, a lot of horrible, horrible events, and a lot of difficulties growing up. And then I came back to Maryland around 2006. So a year after the Intifada was technically over, which was 2005. And so, you know, growing up, I've always had a fascination with history and geography. And I've always talked about Palestine in one way or another, whether it was related to our realities, politics, but also even cool stuff as well. Things about cities, culture. And I wanted to dive more deep into that. So today I actually work as a museum coordinator on Saturdays at the Museum of the Palestinian People located in Washington, D.C. I started out giving tours there as a docent. And, you know, I found it really fun. It gave me a lot of practice when it came to public speaking, but also speaking on very difficult topics, especially topics that, you know, in Western media don't get covered or don't get covered very well. And being a Palestinian, being able to talk about my story and my experiences, you know, we, not as a news journalist or anchor, but as a storyteller and someone who has lived experience and always likes to learn. So, you know, working there has driven me to learn more about Palestine. Not just our struggle, but also resilience, culture, history, the many diverse communities that have come and gone over the centuries and millennia, and a lot more of that. So, you know, it's been a really good place. The museum is like the Palestinian Cultural Embassy in Washington, D.C., which is convenient because of Washington, D.C.'s status in the world stage. And yeah, that's a lot about me.
How old were you when you first heard about Shireen Abu Akleh or saw her on the news?
So when I first saw her on the news, I believe I was living in Palestine. I was living in the city of Ramallah. And so I believe I was 8 or 9 years old when I heard about her. So we'll say like 2003 or 2004.
And what was the general perception or opinion of her?
So interestingly enough, and this kind of ties into the question right before this one. So in Ramallah, I've lived in a few places, a few different neighborhoods, and there was one neighborhood called Al-Masyun. And I think it was still developing at the time as a neighborhood. And so when we were moving to our apartment building, one of the things the people showing us the apartment were saying as like a marker or something significant was that the Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh lives in this building. She lives on the upper floors of the building. And I lived on the third floor out of, I think there was 9 floors total in this building. And, you know, I had her name in the back of my head. And, you know, as children over there, it's like we watched either cartoons or the news, which a lot of times was Al Jazeera because they covered a lot. And so I had exposure to seeing Shireen Abu Akleh's, you know, news reports and everything she had to say. And whenever she would sign off saying Shireen Abu Akleh, Al Jazeera, and whatever location, I was like, oh my gosh, that's the famous lady that lives in my building. Because at the time I never met her, but I knew who she was. And like a lot of people did know who she was because of her impact and being on such a huge channel like Al Jazeera.
Wow. Okay. So when the news about the killing of Abu Akleh was out, how did this affect you personally?
So when I first heard about it, it was around midnight here in the US. And at first I saw one post with her face on it and I said, wait, she looks familiar. Is that Shireen? But I didn't read the captions or anything. I just saw the picture and I didn't think too much of it. I just kept scrolling. And then as I refreshed my page, I started seeing more pictures of Shireen. And I said, wait, why am I seeing her so much? And I found out that she was killed. I believe it was by a sniper, like an Israeli sniper in one of Jenin's refugee camps. And I was totally in shock because although I didn't know her personally, she was in our living rooms. She was on our TV screens. Al Jazeera was usually on, especially during this time in the Intifada. You had to keep up with the news wherever it was. And the person that was reporting a lot on Palestinians and their struggle and different events on the ground was her. She was going to entire war zones or checkpoints or occupied zones, areas that a lot of us probably wouldn't want to be at, or places that were huge with tension, especially with the Israeli military. So, you know, her voice was powerful. A lot of us knew her name in different cities across Palestine.
Yeah, so having Palestinian family, peers, and working at the Museum of the Palestinian People, being surrounded by Palestinians, how did this seem to affect the general Palestinian community around you, as well as how did it affect, if it did, the operations of the museum?
Sure. So it's interestingly enough, of course, many Palestinians were sharing on their stories and posting about Shirina Bouakli's death and her killing, but also I also follow a few people that personally knew her or were family friends. So that added a little bit more of the hits, like the impact of it. And, you know, I worked at the museum one or two days after she was killed. And at the time we were opening a new exhibit called Dreams Rising, which is art by children from Gaza who were born around the time of the Israeli blockade on Gaza. So these are kids that only know the blockade. So during this opening ceremony at the museum for this, you know, amazing event, very beautiful event and impactful and emotional, it was this added emotional layer that, you know, a significant Palestinian journalist who, you know, like I said, when we were kids, she was almost like a celebrity, you know, was killed for documenting and trying to tell the truth about the realities that we face. You know, she died doing her job and, you know, in a way she sacrificed herself for our cause. She was wearing a press vest and helmet. And it's very reminiscent of other times where, you know, nurses or other journalists would also be killed by Israeli military. Like in Gaza, in the Great March of Return, there was, I think her name was Razan al-Najjar. She was a nurse. And it was obvious with her white coat that she was a nurse, but she was gunned down. And I believe Israel still denies that she was killed, or she is accused of associating with militants and whatnot. And so with the killing of Shireen, it's also frustrating for us to hear stories or words being twisted to make it seem like, oh, we don't have conclusive evidence, but we have people that were on the ground, civilians who recorded it as well. So it was just very tough. And the world, especially us, are calling for an independent investigation as well. So it just kind of shows the priorities, you know, we have in the world.
Yeah. Okay. So speaking of that, I was wondering, what implications do you think Shireen's death will have with regard to the supposed protection of journalists under international humanitarian law?
So I believe it does definitely raise a higher concern. And, you know, with Western media, you know, getting through Western media and their censors and the ways that it's being reported on, it's nice to see that, you know, press releases and even American politicians talking about the killing of a journalist. But one thing with Shireen that I've noticed when it comes to at least American media is they emphasize a lot that she was a Palestinian-American journalist. First, I didn't know she was a Palestinian American. I didn't know she had American citizenship. Apparently, she did work here in the States. But would it have been less of a concern if it was just a Palestinian journalist without the dash, like without Palestinian American? If she was just listed as a Palestinian journalist, would it have received as much attention in the US, whether positive or negative, than if she was just a Palestinian journalist? So it just also raises the questions of priorities and double standards, I feel, because world organizations are one thing, but the players in the world organizations are a different factor. You know, like within the UN, there's five countries that really determine the fate of a lot of things, which is the US, UK, France, China, and Russia. So if one of those parties, you know, hops around or, you know, maneuvers or dodges, then even if the other 170 to 180, 190 UN members that aren't those five countries, you know, says something, then it's like their voice is minimized.
That was a part of Mosaic's interview with Mr. Haytham Qureshi, a Palestinian-American working as the museum coordinator at the Museum of the Palestinian People, and his comments regarding the effect of the murder of Shirin Abu Akleh on the Palestinian diaspora.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
The halls of Islamic centers across Canada packed with Muslims on Saturday to celebrate Eid al-Adha, Sacrifice Day, an Islamic festivity. This year's celebrations marked the first time since 2019 that the community was able to gather without pandemic restrictions. The holiday coincides with the annual pilgrimage, Hajj, that happens once a year in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, an event all Muslims are encouraged to embark on at least once in their lifetime. And from Ottawa, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau directed a message to all Muslims across Canada on Eid al-Adha Day.
World will mark the end of the Hajj and celebrate Eid al-Adha. This is a moment for prayer, sharing, sacrifice, and compassion. I know many Muslims look forward to this sacred holiday, from morning prayers to sharing meals to giving back to those in need. It's an important time. And for all of us, it's a chance to reflect on the contributions of Muslim Canadians across the country. Guided by values of respect, empathy, and service, you step up and you help shape our communities for the better. So today, I hope that you find peace and meaning through the practice of your traditions, that you can come together with the family and friends you love, that you can celebrate your community and all it has done for our country. From my family to yours, Sophie and I are wishing you a wonderful Eid al-Adha, Eid Mubarak.
Next week, Mosaic looks forward to speaking with Dr. Awisa Nagor, one of the leaders of the Muslim community in Montreal, and he's also the head of the Egyptian-Canadian Islamic Center in Dollard-des-Ormeaux. Dr. Nagor holds a PhD in Islamic Studies and has established an Islamic Studies program here in Montreal. He's an active member of the society and contributes to the well-being of the Muslim residents of Montreal in so many ways. And now we've come to the end of our show for this week, and it's time to roll into some fun Middle Eastern songs. At the end of our show, I'd like to thank Alice Wu, Pranjal Malik, Reem Araji, Spencer Gilly, and Jack Solar. I'd like to wish you all Eid Mubarak. For the CKUT at 90.3 FM and for the Mosaic Show, this is Sarah Hassanin. Thank you for listening.
so far, though miles apart, still in my heart. Eid al Sa'id, let's enjoy this happy day. Eid al Mubarak, come on, let's celebrate. Eid al Sa'id, let's enjoy this happy day. Eid al Mubarak, come on, let's celebrate. Celebrate, let's celebrate. Allah, Allah, thank you for this day.
مكسر حيتي وحناني ودنيتي راح حبي صحبتي وطلع فستك اه منك صنف خاين وبتاع حركات كل اللي تخاف معايا يعمل لايكات ما هو خد حنيتي وحناني ودنيتي راح حبي صحبتي وطلع فستك
تيجي جنبي نقعد نقعد نتسلم ضيع وقت نروح الفيلا لم حاجتنا نلم الشلة نجيب كراميلا انا جبت اخرها كراميلا الشلة ما صاحبش فرافير حتى لو راكبين فيراري انا صاحب بالتقدير حتى لو اركب اتاري اتاري الدنيا اتاري مش حلوة زي اللي ببالي مش كل اللي تشوفه غالي مش هقدر بس غير اخواتي
دقيت على باب الحياة لما انجرح كفي دقيت على باب الحياة لما انجرح كفي على قد حالي على قد حالي ودنيتي 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 تواد ولا توفي ومشيت في مليون اتجاه والدنيا حالفة كده الدنيا حالفة كده ما بتيجي في يوم صفي
ليه اللاسي ومفتري الدنيا بتبوسه واللي
متشكرين على كل حال
متشكرين على الجرحى الخوف الألم
على هم أتقل من الجبال
يا دنيا ياللي مشايلة دهمهم تقال متشكرين على كل حال
كل حال
متشكرين
Yeah.
I'm going to avoid spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec. Thank you. it's spreading COVID-19. It's easy. I'll wear a mask in crowded places. If I have symptoms, I'll self-isolate and do a rapid test. If I test positive, I'll stay home for at least 5 days. And for the next 5 days, I won't visit anyone who's at risk. I'll avoid social events like festivals and gatherings. And I'll limit my activities to only the most essential, all while wearing a mask and staying 2 meters away from others. The virus is still out there, so we have to be careful. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
TD Bank proudly invites you to the 16th annual Festival Haïti en Folie from July 25th to 31st. Discover Haiti like you've never seen it before through music, food and drink fair, book fair, arts and craft, street parade, and so much more. From July 25th to 31st at Quartier des Spectacles, La Fontaine Park, and Cabaret La Tulipe. For tickets and lineup, visit haitienfolie.com, a Fabienne Colas Foundation event.
This is the Amanda Galas. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.